A busy Tuesday, back together with you on March 19th, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today. We had more details about some alleged Bridgeport irregularities from last election cycle. Institute for Liberty President Andrew Langer dropped by to chat about key Supreme Court cases involving government pressure on social media outlets, and Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio joined us for her weekly update focusing on education and the state's teachers' unions.
So a big thank you. As I started to read this today, I laughed and I chuckled. A big thank you to the Connecticut News Junkie, Jamil Ragland's story that broke late yesterday, right around the time we got off the air, regarding what I like to say is the continued script, the continued treatise, the continued script, teleplay, whatever, screenplay of Bridgeport politics. And we had mentioned this to you over the past couple of days, and we've got even more now. But wait, there's more. Remember how we mentioned a couple of days ago, I think this was actually last week. It was last week the original story broke of further details of what the Secretary of the State's office, Stephanie Thomas, sent to the State Election Enforcement Commission, the SEEC. Now, again, nothing has been decided here. There's always the presumption of innocent until proven guilty. But the Secretary of the State's office, we were talking about this, sent at least four instances that they sniffed out and said, well, were a little, a little weird, a little strange. So now we have even further details of this. And again, this is courtesy of the Connecticut News Junkie. I want to read some of these to you. Now, if you have any thoughts here, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. For example, who would be the best producer and director on this? Timothy Nolan, David Chase, you know, who would play Joe Ganim? Who would play John Gomes? Who would play the voters, the people under the hoodies or whatever? You let me know. All right, according to this story, remember we told you last week that out of 63 voters who were kind of just randomly polled by these election observers, eight of 63 said they got absentee ballots despite nobody in their household requesting them. And to me, all four of these things are a little seedy, but again, this comes down to apparently, now again, they have to investigate this, but if this is as it seems, this certainly comes down to a question of control of absentee ballots, right? We have to stop giving these things out like Skittles. Like candy. The notion that there is, and again, I understand this has to be investigated, but the notion that voting by absentee, especially in Bridgeport, is kind of routine. I don't know about you. It just kind of bothers me. You know, the once or twice in my life I used an absentee ballot, I was like, am I sure I can't get to the polls? Can I come home that day? No, I'll be in class all day. All right. It was almost like I had to twist my own arm to use an absentee ballot. But get this. Now, listen closely. And again, these might be addresses you know, neighborhoods you know in Bridgeport. You may have a little eureka moment, a little aha, a little ding, ding, ding with a light bulb going off your head when you hear some of the stuff that I want to open the show with today. So get this. A student volunteering as an election monitor called 63 residences as part of a spot check for voting irregularities. Okay, the calls were assigned by street and organized in alphabetical order. Once again, by street, says here. Of the 63 calls the student volunteer made, 8 of those they reached reported they received absentee ballots despite not requesting one. Now, here's the additional info we have that we didn't have the other day that is now being ferreted out by many news organizations. 3 of the ballots, in other words, 3 of the alleged AIDS unsolicited absentee ballots. And I don't know what this means. You can tell me whether you know the neighborhood, you put together who was support in the neighborhood, or you get a little aha moment. At 333-9422, three of the ballots went to addresses on Washington Avenue. One went to Waterman Street, one went to Willow Street, and three went to Wood Avenue. So three of the ballots went to addresses on Washington Avenue, one on Waterman Street, one on Willow Street, and three to Wood Avenue. So that's about 12 or 13%. Of the 63 random calls a student was assigned to make to double and triple check any weird things regarding absentee ballots. Okay, the second thing here, and by the way, you want to jump in here, get us going at 333-9422. You think these are much ado about nothing? Am I making too much of this, or are these a little, you know, does this indicate smoke where there's fire? I don't know. Like I said, I don't live in Bridgeport, so I watch this from afar. Like I said all the time, I'm the guy in the upper deck who bought the cheap ticket on StubHub, and I'm up there with my liquid refreshment and my two hot dogs. Number two, a voter indicated during a spot check call that somebody came to his house to help him, had him sign some paperwork, and then took his ballot away. A student volunteer called a Yarmich, forgive me if I'm getting that wrong, Y-A-R-E-M-I-C-H. A student volunteer called a Yarmich Drive voter who told the monitor that a guy, quote unquote, it's in quotes here, a guy came by the house to help fill out the absentee ballot. That guy had the voter sign some paperwork and then took the absentee ballot. The action potentially violates Title IX, as only the voter themselves or a designated third party like a family member or caretaker can deliver an absentee ballot. Okay, so that's one there. And now we get to the juicy stuff. Yes, and I'm not saying that some funky paperwork filler outer isn't juicy, and I'm not saying that people getting absentee ballots when they never asked for them isn't juicy. They're juicy. These are real juicy. A report from a City of Bridgeport employee that a campaign was offering cash in return for completed absentee ballots. What's wrong with that? Hey, you want my vote? Let's go. Pay up. I'm kidding. I'm joking. Sort of. A third-party informant. It's got a little James Bondish thing going here, right? A third. You can't make this up, folks. How about all these cities and towns where the elections are boring? None of this ever happens. But allegedly in Bridgeport, a third-party informant contacted the town clerk's office to report that the Gomes campaign was in a high-rise apartment building on Washington Avenue, informing residents that they would receive cash in exchange for a completed absentee ballot. Folks, I'm just reading this. I don't know whether this is true or not. I can't, you know, vouch for the veracity of this. But you just read that. Read that. I'll read it to you again. A third party informant contacted the town clerk's office to report that the Gomes campaign was in a high-rise apartment building on Washington Avenue, informing residents they would receive cash in exchange for a completed absentee ballot. I'm not saying it's true or not. This is all alleged, but it is in print here. The informant was given that information by a resident of the building. This high-rise on Washington Avenue. When Timothy DiCarlo, the election monitor appointed by the Secretary of the State, tried to contact the voter to verify the information, he was told that he had the wrong number. DiCarlo confirmed the phone number with the third-party informant, who said it came from the apartment residence's voter registration. Wow. A third party. Now, again, this is he said, she said, she said, he said, they said, we said. I get it. But just to let you know, if you haven't had a chance to read this, but you heard me and other hosts around the state talking about this, a third party informant contacted the town clerk's office. So this is somebody calling the Bridgeport town clerk saying, hey, the Gomes campaign, they're alleging the Gomes campaign was in a high-rise apartment building. This is all alleged on Washington Avenue, informing residents they would get cash in exchange for a completed absentee ballot. When Timothy DiCarlo, the election monitor appointed by Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas's office, tried to contact that voter to talk to that voter about what may or may not have happened, he was told that he had the wrong number. But DiCarlo then checked, apparently, and confirmed the phone number with the third-party informant, who said it came from the apartment residence's voter registration. Mm. But wait, there's one more. There's one more. What do you think of this? Is this much ado about nothing? You know, are you going to get, and a lot of people will probably say, well, in a city of 100-something thousand and in an election where X amount of thousands of votes are cast, there's always going to be funny business. It wasn't enough to play with the end of the results, which it wasn't. Nobody's saying it is. But does this stuff still make you shake your head, or is this sour grapes? Is this stuff just to throw chum in the water? Or are you just flipping your arms up in the air and saying, yeah, and? Want to step into this, though, here. Lost in all the news we've had this week, unless you're really snooping out news, you didn't know that there were two key cases argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court that have to do with, shockingly, social media, what social media has the freedom to say, and can the government ever come in and say, hey, we want you to stop that for whatever reason, national security, health issues, whatever. And this is something that I talk about here on the show all the time. As much of a free speech guy as I am, how difficult is it to balance freedom of speech and freedom to conduct your business the way you want to here in the U.S. with the fact that when some of these issues were put forward, there was no ability to say something, whether it was true or not, and to have it go all over the world. Let's welcome Andrew Langer with us. He heads the Institute for Liberty. Check him out online, instituteforliberty.org. Since 2008, Andrew has been the president of the Institute, working on several issues, promoting and protecting, they say, small businesses, linking trade and prosperity, trying to push back against the regulatory state. Andrew, it's Paul here at WICC in Connecticut. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. I'm actually getting ready to head up to your neck of the woods. Going to spend some time on Saturday in the tri-state area celebrating St. Patrick's Day a little late.
Excellent. Now, be careful here in Connecticut because, you know, they may tax you if you stay here too long. So just, you know, watch for the tax police here. Although, Andrew, I do have to say something. I don't know whether you've followed this. We have a rather unique governor here. Ned Lamont is like uber progressive on social issues. But on the business of the state, he's kind of almost a Republican, which is driving the progressives in this state.
Sure.
Absolutely nuts. Andrew, talk about, from your point of view, the two cases or the arguments that were heard in the Supreme Court this week, because to me it's a fascinating argument about what people can say, how they can say it, and is there any role in the government ever stepping in and saying, hey, we wouldn't like you to not allow that. So set that up for my listeners.
There are actually three cases. The one that was argued yesterday is really about an injunction that was issued by the Fifth Circuit regarding the communications that government, the interplay the government can have with these social media platforms. Because you've got this case, you've got the one last week talking about whether or not government officials can block people from their own social media streams. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this New York case in which the state government was putting undue pressure on the insurers for the NRA.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about two very important and intertwined yet discrete issues. One having to do with the line that gets drawn behind, you know, when government can step in, but also this issue of coercion and the ability of government to essentially sidestep, do an end run around the Constitution. What was discussed last week was this issue of whether or not a government official can block somebody from their social media streams, and the court seems to indicate that there may be some, leeway there in the same way that, you know, somebody can be barred from a government property if they're deemed to be a threat or harassing. Again, I have some reservations about that, because certainly that's power that can be abused. The situation in yesterday's arguments, which is both the state of Missouri and Louisiana, essentially challenged the federal government on this issue of what they call colloquially jawboning.
Okay.
And this is this idea of, just stick with me for a second here. So it's a situation in which increasingly we've been seeing the federal government, the executive branch, trying to get at rights that are protected under the Constitution. They know that they can't go after them directly, so they will go after them indirectly. So back during the Obama administration, we had this thing called Operation Choke Point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Obama administration knew that the Second Amendment protected things like firearm sales and firearm manufacturing, and knew that, frankly, in many respects, it protected the concept of short-term high-risk lending. And then for your more libertarian listeners, the First Amendment has some protections for adult entertainers. And weirdly enough, there were folks in the Obama administration who don't like adult entertainers or who didn't like adult entertainers. So they all did the same thing. They put pressure on banks and credit card payment processors to stop doing business with these entities.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it only really came to the forefront because a bunch of porn stars found their bank accounts shut down. Well, that was, once that was exposed, no pun intended, it got shut down. So now we have the Biden administration. They know they can't tilt at the First Amendment directly, but they know that there is speech that's being said out there that they don't like. So they do the same thing. They reach out to these social media platforms. I was a victim of it myself, in point of fact,
mm-hmm.
where they essentially said to the Facebooks and the YouTubes of the world, there's content that we don't like, and you guys are, there's certain things you guys are regulated on. We want you guys to play ball. We can't tell you to censor the speech, but we are seriously encouraging you to take steps to moderate that speech. Otherwise, if you don't, you know what will happen.
Andrew, it would be in your best interest. Is that what they're trying? Are they going full mob here?
That's exactly right.
We wouldn't want
to,
Andrew, we
exactly.
wouldn't want to see you get hurt or anything.
Yeah,
that would
wouldn't
be...
want anything to happen to your business, right? You know, and case in point, right? Look, as soon as Elon Musk gets... The federal government turns around, the executive branch turns around and opens up not one, mm-hmm. not two, but three separate investigations into Elon Musk. And that sends a very clear message out there that if you don't play ball, the full weight of the federal government will be coming after you.
Andrew Langer is the head of the Institute for Liberty. Check him out online, instituteforliberty.org. Okay, so Andrew, what were you able to perceive, and maybe some of your legal eagles there? I did hear a little analysis here. Who indicated what on the court generally by their line of questioning? Is there any clue as to what may happen here?
Right now, I think what's going to happen, and some of this was really indicated by Brett Kavanaugh yesterday, there's a real understanding that you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Obviously there's got to be some kind of interaction with federal agencies when it comes and social media platforms when it comes to activities that are categorically illegal, things mm-hmm. that impact the health, the safety, the welfare of groups of people or individuals. But the real issue comes down to this issue of censorship and going after what is protected speech. You know, you have an opinion about something and you voice that opinion. I'll give you a really good example.
Sure.
I do a podcast called Andrew and Jerry Save the World. Yes, I'll put in a shameless plug there.
Okay.
With a guy named Jerry Rogers. He's the editor of Real Clear Policy. He's the editor of Real Clear Health.
Mm-hmm.
And during the pandemic, you know, Jerry's reading everything that comes across his desk regarding the pandemic and everything. I'm like, you know, I grew up in a household of scientists and epidemiologists.
Wow.
So I have a pretty good understanding of that arithmetic. But Jerry is talking about, you know, the efficacy of masks, the efficacy of social distancing, and reading through legitimate scientific journal articles. Well, guess what? We get flagged by YouTube and our episode gets taken down.
Wow.
That's the issue here. You know, you have a recognized expert, someone for whom this is his bread and butter, as it were, and yet somebody at YouTube is going to make the decision. Probably under the pressure of somebody by the federal government.
Yeah, and Andrew, it drives me crazy because, listen, and I like to hearken back to the days pre-electronics where you had freedom of speech and somebody was on the street corner and they'd be yelling and screaming. And with the good ingenuity of people, they would say, he's a nice guy, but I think he's a little bit nuts here. And they were able to walk away. And I think, Andrew, what has happened here, and I always say this, with the pervasiveness of the Internet and the web and the ability of me or you to say anything and click on it and send it all over the world, I think that the burden really needs to be on people, like you say, to sit back and say, and I tell this to people all the time on my show, Andrew, no matter what side of the political aisle you're on, when you see something, take a breath, think about it, and say, okay, this seems a little weird to me, or I agree with this, but let me do some further investigation. Google and Yahoo, they're your friends. Sit there for a half an hour and try to use your own mind instead of mandating that the government do it for you.
Right. And, you know, it's funny because I a line that I use when I broadcast is the line from Lincoln. Time is a great thickener of things. And one of the worst things to happen in America, worldwide, frankly, is the hot take as the driving force in terms of social media. Notice, but you hit the nail on the head. We have to be much, much more discerning about things, and we shouldn't let somebody else out there be the arbiter of what's out there. As you know, one of my great mentors, a guy named Michael Grivo, when I was the Competitive Enterprise Institute, he said, you want the most speech that's out there, because if there is that person who is shouting on the proverbial street corner, you can look at that person and say, you know something, that's somebody I want to steer clear of. That's exactly it.
All right. Again, instituteforliberty.org. Andrew Langer. Andrew, before we let you go, why don't you give us one more shameless plug for your podcast? What is it again?
Well, listen, I actually do three of them, but I also want to put in a plug for the work that I'm doing with CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Coalition.
Yep.
I run their Center for Regulatory Freedom, do a podcast for them. But Andrew and Jerry Save the World, or my weekly lunch hour podcast, go and check that out. It's an interview show. I just interviewed Coach Joe Kennedy this week of the famous Supreme Court case, Kennedy versus whatever the school district was.
Oh, sure. When do you have time to do anything else? What, like four or five podcasts, and you work for this organization?
Listen, that's just it. It's a labor of joy, so it's not work there, Paul.
Excellent. Andrew, stay in touch. Andrew Langer, the Institute for Liberty, and about 14 different podcasts. Andrew, thanks, and enjoy your time up here in the Northeast. Be very afraid of the tax goons, and have a nice time, but head out as soon as you can, okay?
Will do. Take care.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it. All right, good guy there. Institute for Liberty, Andrew Langer. This being Connecticut Today, we like to keep an eye, as you know, as to what goes on in our big cities and at the state capitol. One of the folks who watches the capitol situation many, many hours watching CTN, Megan Portfolio here of the Yankee Institute. She writes the Hartford Portfolio, and Megan is with us this afternoon. New week. How are you?
I'm well. Good afternoon.
Your piece here has an interesting title, and I'm glad you've written about this, because this is something that's been going on for a few years now. If only low-income kids had a union, and this has to do with what, Megan? The two main Connecticut teachers unions still battling a couple of schools that are kind of in limbo here that the General Assembly first okayed a few years back. So fill us in on this.
Yeah, this actually, I was getting so enraged when I was writing this story because, mm-hmm. like, union greed, I get it. Everyone wants to make money. You know, I want to make money. I get it. But don't mess with kids. Like, that's where I draw the line. And there's a couple issues going on.
Okay.
Yes, there's these two charter schools, one in Danbury, and which was approved, I can't remember, but it was approved like many years ago. I want to say around 2015. And then one in Middletown that was recently approved. They went through all the steps. It's a ton of paperwork they have to fill out. They have to show need. They have to have public hearings. And so it's a lot of work to actually get the okay to do this. So they finally got the okay. And they just won't get funded by the General Assembly. Middletown was very, very close last year. And then at 11:48, 12 minutes before midnight, mm-hmm. before the session closed, the teachers union stepped in and said, nope, they pulled the funding. So this group of activists is actually really interesting. I actually went to it. It was at the end of February. They're the Connecticut Parents Union held a press conference at the LOB, demanding, money for these schools. And what was interesting about that, only one representative showed up, and it was Rep. Chalutsky from Danbury, who's been like a huge champion for the Danbury schools.
Mm-hmm.
But all these lawmakers that, it's about the equity, it's about the kids, they were in the building. They didn't have time to and they were invited to this press conference, but they didn't show up. And it was just, all a bunch of activists, some from Middletown, some from Danbury, just, begging for this money. And the organizer, Gwen Samuel, you got to get her on the show. She's
I haven't had Gwen on in a while, but I remember her from my previous talk show, Stop. Yeah, she's a good lady, very passionate and very angry about this stuff. And, Megan, just to go over some details here. Yeah, the Danbury Prospect Charter School was okayed in 2018, and the Capital Prep School in Middletown was greenlit in 2023. And I'm glad you're reading about this because these schools do have an approval, and a lot of these magnet schools and charter schools help minority students, Latinos, African-American students, stay away from bad schools. But boy, I got to tell you, the teachers' unions, they bristle. In this case, Megan, I think you're right. Their first notion is choking off the charter schools and the welfare of the kids is second.
And we're not talking, no one's saying to not fund public schools.
No.
Absolutely. I am not advocating for pulling money from the public schools. You can do two things at one time, teachers' union.
Yeah.
You can fund your public schools. And we can do other options because you're letting kids fall through the cracks. And one of the things that Gwen Samuel had said, she wants to see these kids have college IDs, not prison IDs. And I thought that was like, that was like the oh my God moment of like the whole thing for me. I was like, what a great, that's such a simple sentence, but it's so true. Why are you being an obstacle? So you've got these two schools, but there's also this other concept that Yankee Institute is supporting. And if anyone's interested in submitting, something to lawmakers, you can go to yankeeinstitute.org, take action page, and we have a link there for that. Okay. It's basically to get a tax credit to people that donate to certain organizations that help give scholarships to kids that are like at poverty level. These are not going to rich kids. These are not going to middle-class kids. These are the kids that their families are struggling financially and they're desperate. And it gives these people that want to donate a tax credit, and then these organizations get a scholarship to send these kids to private school. What's the big deal? No money is coming out of the public school for this. We were actually, saying like last year we gave $122 million for film tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a couple million dollars, again, not coming from the public school budget. And teachers' unions came out at the public hearing last week all up in arms. But the one that really, really upset me was this one woman who's a teacher. She's a teacher / union boss in New Haven, whose New Haven scores in math, English, and in science have gone down. They have not reached pre-pandemic levels.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an issue in her city where she is a teacher. Instead of like having like a discussion about the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. She wants to sit there and start and she's conspiracy theories. Oh, the Koch brothers are for this.
Oh, my God.
Trump is for this. Oh, Betsy DeVos. None of those people have testified for this bill or even know about this bill.
When in doubt, Megan. When in doubt, it's Trump derangement syndrome. When in doubt. Oh, my God.
When I heard that, I'm like, Trump isn't even here. Trump probably couldn't care less about this little scholarship. It's like, come on. And so it's, and then this other guy, here's this other one. I just pulled these two out. A bunch of them really upset me, but I only had a certain amount of hours to write this thing. He's a union boss for the universities who's crying. I hear him crying. Oh, we need to have our universities funded. Well, here's an idea. Let's get kids to be able to get to the point where they can go to college mm-hmm. and they can go to your college
pay
and
tuition.
And there's your money. It's like these people don't even think about it. And they're so closed-minded. And you're literally, and there was actually this whole class, I want to say probably about 50 kids all in these green shirts mm-hmm. the day at the public hearing.
Yeah.
And one of the girls, I don't know, I can't tell age of the kid, but maybe she was in the fifth or sixth grade.
Okay.
Testifying in favor of this bill.
Yeah.
She goes to a private Jewish school.
Yeah.
And she's like, why can't other kids like have this opportunity as I have? And so these teachers are looking at these kids in the face and like,
Megan, the only thing they care about is when it comes down to push versus shove, I'm telling you, it is to them. Any inch given by the union, even if it helps kids, that they don't like. Megan Portfolio, thank you, folks. If you want to check this out, you go to the Yankee Institute or you Google the Hartford Portfolio. And once again, the title of this from Megan, If Only Low-Income Kids Had a Union. Megan, have a spectacular week. Go easy on the CTN. Take a deep breath. If people are annoying you, and we'll talk next week, okay?
All right, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Megan. Appreciate it. Megan Portfolio there. Yeah.